How you
Daniel.
guys? Hi, how you guys doing?
Doing really
Good.
well. How are you this morning?
I'm well, thank you.
Like your brick fireplace.
It's
Sweet.
actually, yeah, it's a wall. It's the whole wall.
Oh, that's fantastic. I also like the painting on there as well.
Yeah, thanks. That's my mom's.
Oh, that's great.
Super cool. Yeah. Are you in New York?
I'm in Brooklyn, yeah.
Brooklyn, okay. So it's the real Brooklyn brick. It's not the faux New York
Oh
style loft.
no. This is real Brooklyn brick. I found a place that's nicely, it's a nice sort of middle ground between, it's like an old but refurbished building. So it's not one of these like super new hyper modern places. It feels like New York, but it also feels like the place that rats don't have standard shit,
Refreshed, New York refreshed.
Yeah. Touched up a little. So where are you guys based?
Calgary, Alberta.
Oh, my dad was just there, I think.
Yeah, we
Yesterday.
saw that this morning. Zach and I were like, it wasn't really advertised widely, so it was in the know on the WordPress event circuit, I think, but.
Gotcha.
Hopefully he enjoyed it. It's a little chilly. We've got lots of snow at the moment,
Well,
but
that's what happens when you choose to live in the prairies.
it's true. It's a true story.
Have you made your way up to Calgary before?
Oh, sure. I've driven to Calgary from Vancouver several times.
Yeah.
How long have you been in New York for,
Well,
Daniel?
this is my second stint, and it's about a year now. Before that, I lived here for 9 years. I went to grad school at NYU, got my musical theater writing degree there, and then I left in 2014. So then I was in Victoria for a while. Then I was in a bunch of places, but now I'm back.
And that's a
York's a
place
hard
you want to
city.
be.
Look, if you're going to be serious about writing musical theater, this is where the talent is. This is where the industry is. Not that I'm that, I mean, a lot of the writing can happen wherever you are, but it also just happens to be the case that I feel like I'm on some level a New Yorker at heart. If I could split my time between Victoria and New York and skip Vancouver altogether, I would. But yeah, New York really is good for my soul in some way, and it's the right place to be right now.
I hear the Phantom of the Opera is going in February.
Yeah, it's closing finally after like 40 years or some crazy something.
How do you feel about that?
I feel just fine. I've never seen it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot of shows in the musical theater canon that I've never seen them. Some of them I really ought to see, and some of them I'm really fine
It's probably
not
because
seeing.
you see it with the different ear and or an eye and just the feel, right? From an audience that doesn't see it the way you do, it's like we're like
No,
mesmerized.
yeah, well, sure. People go to the theater for different things. There's the spectacle side of it, just to see an incredible thing unfold in front of you. And you know what? Maybe I should see it once, I can go see a show on that level. As a writer, as a lyricist, I do listen for craft. And Andrew Lloyd Webber, when he's at his best, is a really interesting composer. Like Jesus Christ Superstar, that's cool ass music. But once he got to Phantom of the Opera in the 80s, like Jesus Christ Superstar was like 71 or something. Once he started doing these big, grand, epic musicals, and he's working with Tim Rice, the lyricist, I tend to find it's all a wash. Like I'm not, it doesn't sweep me along the way it might sweep others. But then again, I've never really given it a chance, and I've been proven wrong before. So, but I do, it is kind of a curse that you have to, especially on Broadway. When I see shows in other cities, I go in with a different mentality. But when you're paying Broadway ticket prices, yeah, it's always different when it's like something you yourself do.
Have you seen Wicked?
I've actually never seen Wicked. That's a show that I wouldn't mind seeing. I have friends who have been in Wicked, including an ex-girlfriend of mine who played Elphaba for a while. But yeah, I mean, that's a show that the lyrics make me cringe, but I think it would be a great spectacle.
I watched it in London, and oh my God, it was fun.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of fun. Yeah. I mean, flying, Greenwich. Yeah, I mean, what's not to love?
Absolutely. And congrats, by the way, on your book.
It feels great.
Yeah,
it feels great. And it feels a lot better than I was afraid it would, which is a weird thing to say, because it was obviously objectively an exciting milestone for me. But I was trepidatious. I wasn't sure what it was going to be like getting attention for something that is primarily associated with my father, to be quite honest. Always had a bit of an identity crisis when it comes to me and him. I think when I was 9 or 10, I said to him, I don't know where you end and I begin. And that hasn't ever really fully resolved itself, really, until this book has come out in a weird way. Somehow with the release of the book, I'm very clear on where he ends and where I begin. And it's ironic that that's happened through a collaboration together. And, but in a way it makes sense, because in collaborating, you have to be clear on what your roles are, what you're each bringing to the table, what you're both good at, and letting the point of a collaboration is to let each other shine and let each other contribute, and then to let go of the individual identity and create something with a joint voice. And being in musical theater, I've done that many times with many other people. I don't always write alone. Sometimes I do, but sometimes I do lyrics and the other person does music, and it's delightful. It's just a different experience. So somehow in doing that, there was a sense of self-definition. Like I could see, I could feel like I could stand for my own talents and also be humble about who I'm not. And then with the release of the book, I mean, leading up to the release of the book, I was kind of glum. I was expecting it to be kind of a drag to only be associated with him. And there's a voice in my ego that was like, oh, you know, but my musicals, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, my musicals are, many of them are still waiting to be produced, but that's how it goes. That's just how it goes in this business. As far as being associated with this book, I'm very, very proud of it. First of all, the response has been extraordinarily positive, like rapturously positive, and people are very grateful for it. People are clearly connecting with it. People are hungry for it, and they're getting a lot of knowledge and sustenance and comfort and empowerment from it. So that's, you know, that's a pretty good feeling. And people want to talk to me, it seems, independently from my dad. I mean, he was the one who went on Rogan and Democracy Now. He gets the big ticket invitations, but I'm getting to talk to all kinds of very interesting, more niche, more specialized, more local, more grassroots shows, podcasts, and sometimes we get interviewed together. So, you know, we were on stage together at the Toronto Authors Festival. We got interviewed together in Jacobin Magazine, which is the U.S. sort of Bernie Sanders left-wing sort of political magazine. And I was really stoked about that, because that's kind of a circle that I overlap with, right? So long story short, I have found actually the attention I'm getting feels both earned and manageable and reasonably specific to me. And it feels right. Like it feels aligned, like it fits, and I'm not sheepish about it. And I think something in me has been waiting for a long time to have a platform to be invited to speak about all manner of things. But unlike my dad, who's put in decades of work as a doctor and then an author, and unlike my brother, who's made quite a name for himself as an independent journalist, my work hadn't connected with a broader public yet. So now I get to do that. And it's really pleasant.
But you're able to shine within your own community of musical theater and the arts. You've been pretty prominent there.
Yeah. Well, let's be real. I mean, prominent, no, not within it. I've been recognized at various moments. I'm respected among a certain crowd of people who are tapped into new musicals, but particularly people who are in my like NYU alumni network, actors, certainly here in New York, like new musical theater actors who there's, you know, there's a class of actors who really love, I mean, all actors go out for big roles. Everyone wants to be on Broadway, but there's a class of actors who really love being involved with new projects from the beginning, which means not directly being cast in a production, but being cast in a 1 week reading of a show, of a first draft, of learning the score, singing it at music stands, and that's it for a while. And I have a lot of friends in that class, many of which are also Broadway veterans. But among that group of people, I'm very well respected because they like singing my stuff because I write smart, catchy musical theater about things that interest them, you know? So that feels good. And then there's been moments here and there where I've won this award or that award. But those are always a bit of a mixed bag because they usually come with a sort of, like the biggest award I won was called the Kleban Prize, which is, you know, quite a substantial purse to it. But it's for the most promising lyricist in musical theater. And that was in 2013. And so sometimes you walk through life after years and years of a show not moving forward or not knowing what you're going to write next. You walk around feeling a bit like a broken promise. So it isn't the case that like your average musical theater fan will have heard of me or even that major Broadway producer. But some have, and it always surprises me. So that's nice. Again, I left New York for like about 7 or 8 years. So it's fitting that I'm reminding people that I exist again and starting to reinvest again in that side of my work.
Oh, for sure. Mandy, do you have any questions for Daniel?
I just, as you're talking, Daniel, I'm just so curious. You talked a little bit about, you know, realizing when you were 9 or 10, how it was challenging to figure out the differentiation or, you know, as we come into young adolescence, into young adulthood, where we separate from our parents.
Yes.
And, you know, how that's inspired some of the paths that you've gone on in your life. Like if that plays a role in some of the music that you write or another thought, my brain's like popcorn. It likes to percolate lots of questions all at once. But in the writing with your father on this last project that you did together, in a way, it sounds like it was a healing experience for further healing the relationship.
I would say so. Yeah, I would say so. You know, we define healing as a natural movement towards wholeness. And so both in the relationship with each other, seeing each other in our wholeness, me getting to see a more vulnerable side of him, an insecure side, a nervous side, a side that needs help. You know, he really needed my help on this, and him getting to see me as, you know, not to be reductive, but, you know, as a man, like as a grown up, capable artisan, bringing my own skills to the table and helping him make something happen that he really, really wanted to, but wasn't sure he could. That's healing. That fills in some blanks in terms of seeing each other as fully three-dimensional people. It also brings, in some ways, some new context to old dynamics because we would get upset at each other in very, very familiar ways. He would react to stress in ways that reminded me very much of the ways he used to react to stress back when his reactions to stress were traumatizing to me. And yet now I'm in my 40s and it actually isn't having that effect, but my nervous system doesn't know the difference. So I react the way I've always reacted. And then I'm in cope mode and then he's in reaction mode and we're off to the races. But the nice thing is, since we're working on a project for which there's a big book contract and a big audience waiting and both, and never mind all that, inside both of us, there's a strong motivation and intention to get it done and do it really well. We didn't have time to sit and indulge that stuff. We had to move through it. We had to change our perspective on it so we can get back to work, which is what a professional relationship does. You know, I don't know if Joe Montana and Jerry Rice or, you know, I don't want to trigger you guys, but, you know, Wayne Gretzky and Yari Curry, and to take an Edmonton example, or I don't know, or I could talk about Johnny Gaudreau, but I know he's a sore spot in Calgary too. But I don't know that. Yeah. I don't know that the best teammates are always the best friends. Mm-hmm. Michael Jordan and Dennis Rodman, for let's say, you know, there can be personal beef in the locker room, but when they get out on the ice or out on the court or in the field, it's game time. And that was a really helpful context for the two of us. It was kind of like, okay, cool. You got issues. Your father and son, welcome to the club. What are we creating? What really matters? And then that helps me let go of things. And then, yeah, seeing myself as capable, seeing myself as separate and independent, having to set boundaries that I'd never really known how to set just for my own sanity. Like at one point when I just felt that my dad was taking out his stress on me and just offloading it, at one point I said to him, I have limits. And if you need support with the writing of this book, I request that you go find a therapist.
Which is a hard thing to do.
It is, especially when you're Mr. Therapist, you know, when you're, and when, you know, like the doctor, he always was reluctant to go see a doctor. And I think he sometimes can buy into his own mythology that he knows it all and now he just needs to apply it. But no, sometimes you actually need emotional support. Like at a particular moment in your life, you know? So again, it was like seeing his vulnerability, but not taking on the burden of it's my job to make everything okay for you past the point where it's healthy for me, because then I can't do my best work and then my health suffers. And it's also just not what I signed up for.
No, for sure.
You know?
Are you the youngest child?
I'm the oldest, actually, of three. Okay.
So there was pressure on you, of course. Was mom like that as well, or just dad? Was mom your safety in all this?
Intermittently, yes. But the problem was, and it wasn't pressure of the kind that like helicopter parents put on their kids. Like it wasn't pressure to succeed or excel at external things. But it was a kind of pressure to... It was a pressure cooker in the sense of I had to work very hard to maintain an equilibrium in a home that was very emotionally and even intellectually chaotic. A lot of words flying around, a lot of emotional energy underneath the words that didn't match the words sometimes. And my parents' relationship was the dominant force in the home, not their obligation as parents. And when I say obligation, I just mean nature has an agenda for raising kids. And the whole point of our book is that our society doesn't set parents up to succeed. They're distracted by their own trauma. They're distracted by economic woes, by other kinds of stresses, their own mental afflictions, their own addictions, whatever. In the case of my parents, they were acting out their traumatic, dysregulated upbringings through their relationship with each other, which was sometimes, you know, idyllic and euphoric, which made me uncomfortable too. Or it was, they were at each other's throats, which was very terrifying. And again, I experienced myself as collateral damage a lot of the time. So mom, I think, really wanted to be my safe place, but she was hampered in her own ways by her being plugged into that relationship in ways that didn't allow her to focus on the kids in the way that she would have wanted to. And she has said, and she said publicly, so I'm not talking out of school here, that if she could do it all over again, if she had known herself better, if she'd been, you know, more developed and individuated as a person, she would have left my dad when we were small. And I completely agree with her that that probably would have been better for us. Now, she believes that even in that case, they would have found their way back to each other because they're meant to be soulmates and all that. I'm not going to argue with that. They just celebrated the 53rd anniversary. They're great together. They've learned a lot. But they realized too late that that came at a cost and that it was done in a way that was kind of with blinkers on as to the impact on the world around them.
You know, everybody's got their own traumas. At home, what was it like growing up, being the oldest? Dad comes home from work. Was it always were you afraid? It's almost like the alcoholic dad coming home.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that in my case is maybe illustrative for other people, because we distinguish between two kinds of trauma in the myth of normal, the capital T and the small T trauma, big T, small T. Mm-hmm. Big T is events that happen that are damaging, that should not have happened in a perfect world, that violate a child's dignity or sense of safety. And that can be everything from the catastrophe that my dad lived through, the historical catastrophe of the Holocaust, right? And near starvation and sickness and being separated from his mother. That's an extreme kind of duress and adversity, preverbal. It can be abuse, sexual, verbal, physical. It can be witnessing abuse in the home. It can be addiction or mental illness in the home. It can be a rancorous divorce. It can be, assault. So those things not everybody has. And I would say that I have I had something on the mild end of big T, which was my dad yelled frequently when he would get upset. His way of expressing his emotions would be to yell about his emotions uncontrollably, but using very like self-aware sounding words, which was terrifying to me, because on one level it was very controlled. The language was, the vocabulary was controlled, but the energy underneath it was just totally chaotic. And there was no awareness that this should not be happening in front of the kids, in front of me, in front of, or in the home at all, you know? And then he did hit me once. That was not the norm, but that was just a more extreme version of being kind of shocked and terrorized. I would say my nervous system was on constant alert. Yeah. There was fear, but there were also very warm times. And so the main thing beyond the individual incidents was the small T trauma of the insecurity of not knowing when things would turn, and of feeling not seen, and of having to cope and adjust in order to stay ahead of everything. So trauma, you asked what is trauma, or can I give an example of trauma? Small T trauma is just any internal wound that we sustain that constricts us or limits us over time. And usually that takes the form of a separation inside the self, a fracturing of an estrangement from parts of oneself. So some people get estranged from their healthy anger. Some people get estranged from their bodies. That's often a common reaction to people who are sexually abused, you know, because it's to protect themselves. It's too much, you know. In my case, the trauma took the form of kind of an ADD mind that would both tune out but also race very fast, a kind of bipolar tendency, which really has played out throughout my adult life. Big ups, big downs, never the twain shall meet, no one at home in the middle watching it, until quite recently, actually. I'm doing much better with it now. So, and you know, and then there are the traumas of feeling betrayed. So if my mom, for instance, would buckle under the stress, and if I felt she was there and she were to modify a piece, I know in some, not her fault, but it's just, this was my experience. Well, that is another kind of trauma, a kind of deep disappointment, and the child, and it's not a one-time disappointment. The child at that age, everything is about them. So they have to make some decision about themselves that, A, either it's my fault, or at least I'm the one who has to prevent this from happening again. So I'm going to have to change my personality. I'm going to have to develop a thicker skin or a new coping mechanism or develop a new superpower. And like I often say in these interviews, every superhero has a tragic origin story of where the superpower came from. So what's interesting about trauma, as viewed through the lens of this book, is if you're looking for your trauma, if it's hard to find, you might want to start by looking at your greatest personality strengths, the things that you compulsively get praise for, that you pride yourself on, but that on some level you can't stop doing. And they sometimes even get you into trouble. Like some people are too clever for their own good, or too attractive for their own good, or too charming for their own politicians. Well, those overdeveloped personality traits are often the outgrowth. They're the structure that the protective gauze that the personality develops to protect that wound. So that's where the wound is. It's underneath that.
Interesting.
Defense mechanisms. We learn how to survive, the survival things that we, you know, develop and curate as children that left unattended or unaware continue to evolve and grow into part of our persona.
Absolutely. And I think curate is a good word, except it's not done consciously. If it was done consciously, that would be better. So if when I'm 25 years old, I could say, wow, I have these defense mechanisms. Look at me. I'm defending myself by always having to be the joker in the room, or wow, look at me. I'm then I can have some choice to lay down my sword and shield, you know, as the song goes. But if I think it's who I am, which is one layer of the myth of normal, we normalize these coping responses, and then they just become our second skin. And then I think, well, this is who I am, love me or leave me. But I can't imagine not being that way. No. So considering that behavior is not actually the core of who I am, but it's a structure, a coping structure, a defensive structure on top of a wound, it's going to subvert my whole identity. And our identities protect us in a lot of ways from whatever perceived threat or real threat we faced early in life.
For sure. When do you start this, you know, curse, I call it?
Well, do you have kids?
No.
Are you planning to?
Not too sure yet.
Okay. Well, if you don't, that's one way to stop the curse. You can also develop a podcast that shares this information with people. That's another way of giving the world an antidote. But it's about becoming conscious and saying and choosing. It was just automatic for him. He inherited it. He passed it on. He didn't think anything of it. It was normal. For you, it's abnormal. You can see the effects. You know, now different cultures are different cultures, and different cultures tend to err in different ways. You know, but realizing, hey, you know what, whatever benefit this might have had for me, if it had any, it's had a lot of other ill effects. It's affected my level of trust. It's affected my anger or whatever it is, you know? I mean, look, if the generations of British colonial masters who caused a lot of the trauma that affected the continent that you were born on, and the generations of, I mean, where do you think, where do you think your dad and your grandfather and all that learned that? I'm guessing that does not go back to African traditional pedagogical methods.
No, it was the British.
Where does it,
colony.
It was the British, and who, and what kind of schools were they raised in? Absolute concentration camps of terror and obedience and worshipfulness of authority. And I mean, I'm using concentration camps a little loosely, but those kids were terrorized, and only the strong survived, and the weak, sometimes the weak died or they fell by the wayside, and the ones who bucked up underneath it and then identified with the authority figures, they went on to be military commanders and boat captains and, you know, regimental leaders of colonies on other continents. And then they took out they outsourced and offloaded their trauma onto other people that they had to see as weaker and inferior because they hated their own vulnerability. So, you know, I always come back to the Matrix. It's a really good analogy for a lot of things, allegory, I should say. How does Neo break the cycle? He breaks out of the Matrix. How does he do that? By first noticing the glitches. That's weird. Did you just see that? That's something's not lining up, and allowing himself to question it. And that opened a little door, and that opens the rabbit hole, and he goes down, and then he chooses the red pill when it's offered to him, you know, because something about the taste of freedom and the unknown is more appealing to him than the comfortable, safe drudgery and monotony, the predictable familiarity, but deadening familiarity that his life is made up of. And something in him is calling him to reconnect with who he really is, even if it's going to be a very rude and unpleasant awakening with a lot of hardship and deprivation, you know. But some people in that movie choose the opposite, the, you know, the, the character, you know, Joe Pantolin, what's his name? Pantolantonio. I forget. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I met him once, Joey Pants, his character, you know, he goes for the steak dinner and to him, it's like, no, I'd rather stay in the dream. Thank you very much.
Pantoliano. And these are the choices. There we go.
Pantoliano. Yeah, exactly. He goes by Joey Pants. That's what people call him. Great character, great performance. And that's an example of an understandable, but ultimately given what he knew and given who, what was at stake and who he was betraying, and a villainous choice, a self-preserving in the most narrow sense, not really self-preserving, but identity preserving, comfort preserving, which is the kind of self-interest that our capitalist toxic culture sells us, that self-interest is the root of all economics and meaning, self-interest in the narrow, narrow sense. I'm totally going off here. We're in some other, on some other topic now, but you know, tribal peoples understood that self and the self is much bigger than just the individual. And if you really want to have self-interest, you better keep the whole community in mind. Otherwise everyone's dead.
We all have choices. How did you know to stay on that path and not let substance such as alcohol or drugs take you down?
Well, it doesn't take substances to take a person down. I mean, as we say in the book, addiction has nothing to do with substances. Substances are just a stand-in for the, actually for the brain chemicals that we're lacking and that we're looking for, whether the pain relief or the motivational circuits or the, what's the other one? Sort of the love chemicals, you know? And you can get those just as much from pornography, gambling, compulsive shopping. My dad got it from buying classical compact discs, for God's sakes, you know? So anything can like bring us down in the sense of further separate us from ourselves because we're just trying to stay afloat. You said we all have a choice. I'm going to contest that actually. Theoretically we do, intellectually we do, but until you have a choice, you don't have a choice. Until you see things clearly and can see your options and get what's at stake, it's not really a choice. You're just acting out a script. You know, I do this thing called mental chiropractic with people. This is my own little niche thing I've developed, which is, you know, because I'm not a therapist. I don't have the patience and endless compassion of my dad. I've got compassion, but it's a kind of compassion that's like, it's a hurry up compassion. It's like, okay, I got it. We're all traumatized. What do you want? what's blocking you right now? Let's not wait until you're completely healed to get unstuck. And one of the things I say to people is, if you're stuck, like I was walking with someone yesterday, these walks are by phone. So I'm walking where I am, they're walking where they are. So this woman was in Florida and she was stuck in her life. And I said, well, what's your working theory? Why are you stuck? She says, well, I'm wallowing and I'm choosing to numb myself out in the list. And I said, okay, so cool. So if that's the answer, when we get off this call, why don't you just choose something else? Does that explanation free you up at all? Does it give you any power? Does it shift your view at all? She said, no, not at all. I said, well, then you don't actually have the choice you say you have, because you can only, a choice means you have choice of how you can look at the situation, not just options of what to do. You know, if you're stuck in one paradigm and all you can see is the option, if you can only see the options through one lens, then you're always going to pick the one that makes the most sense within that context. But if you can shift your perspective, so for instance, I don't think your dad had a choice as to whether to, you know, raise you in a corporal punishment environment. He didn't have that choice, unfortunately, tragically, and in a costly way. But you, because you see it for what it is, you question it, and you imagine that it could be otherwise, and you do a cost-benefit analysis, and you're like, no, I'd rather take the risk that, let's say you were a parent, I'd rather take the risk that my child is going to behave in ways I don't like than to get them to behave in the ways I do like. Choice comes when you see the situation for what it is, and you see that there's a cost on either side, and then you can choose which one you want. So back to the question you asked, and these are such long-winded, detoury kind of answers. I hope they take us somewhere interesting. I guess you and your listeners will be the judge of that. But how have I chosen that? I haven't always. I've slipped and fallen. I've had a lot of catastrophes in my life. I had a terrible divorce from a really misguided marriage. Heartbreaking, you know? And I've had tons of depressions and drugs. I mean, I've relied on marijuana way more than would have been healthy for me. But I couldn't see why not. Until recently, where I'm like, no, there's something I prefer about being sober. I'd rather deal with the discomfort. But that's when I got to the point where I was less afraid of my own boredom, less afraid of my own. And I still go through cycles. And, you know, right now I'm in a good time in my life. Everything's going great. I got a book out and I'm writing musicals. I just bought a piano here. So it's, you know, I've got lots to do. When I'm feeling lower and when things aren't going as well, that's the challenging time. But ultimately, even if I slip up, that doesn't mean it's bringing me down. It's not a movie, you know. Life is complex, and even if you're climbing a mountain, there's going to be dips, there's going to be valleys, there's going to be, you know, sometimes you're in the foothills, so you got to go up and you got to go down, and then there's the next mountain. So it's been very important for me not to be too severe with myself, because if I'm too severe with myself in the healing game, then I'm not actually subverting my trauma or healing it. I'm amplifying it, because that severity, that needing to be perfect or needing to be right, that's just an enlightened version of the childhood that I'm trying to escape, you know? So it's about creating a new context, a new attitude, a new point of view that's actually freeing the minute I take it on. I don't need to wait till some sweet by and by when I'm fully healed. No, if I'm healing, then I'm moving towards wholeness, and I can actually reap the benefits right now, even as I continue to learn and grow and work things through. And
Daniel, it really sounds like you've developed a new skill set on how to discriminate your focus and shift it. And really you're tapping into the beauty of humanness, which is imperfection, right?
I think that's really important.
Right. The fantasy of perfection, or once we reach a certain station, you know, if we're three, you know, subway stops down the way and we get to Broadway, that's where our happy place is. It's really learning how to be present. And as you said, sitting in the discomfort with skill, which most people don't see it that way. Right.
I think skill is a fantastic word that, you know, if everyone could onboard that word, what it carries with it is a skill takes practice. And you don't have it until you have it. And sometimes you have to do something and mess up at it many times. Like riding a bike is a skill, and it's not an indictment of you that the first time you got on a bike, you toppled over, and that the second time the same thing happened. Maybe you toppled over to the other side. At a certain point, something clicks and your body goes, oh, I know how to shift. I can feel it. And you know, you said discrimination. Another word for that is discernment. You know, you can discern between this and that. You can see, is this aligned with my healing? Is it not? How does this actually feel for me? What are the actual impacts? It's very important to get out of the comparison game, whether comparing yourself to others or to some idealized version of yourself. And I actually wrote a song about that once called Parallel Universe Me. There's a video of me singing it on YouTube. The more recent one is the one to listen to, because when I originally wrote it, the lyrics were different and they're a lot better now. And it ends with this declarative statement, because the whole song is me, or the character is basically based on me, describing this parallel universe self who is constantly there. I'm always like thinking about him. I'm always imagining him. He's basically a presence in my life, and he's awesome. He's attractive and active and cool. Everyone wants to be around him. He's sexy. He owns the night. He's, you know, where the action is, that's where he is. He's perfect. He can set goals and achieve them and all this. And he's like looking at me all the time being like, are you seeing this? This is who you could be in the parallel universe, you know? But by the end of the song, the lyrics go, here's the deal, my friend. Here's the thing, my friend, I'm going to have to end our deal here. Your life looks really fun, but I'm the only one who's real here. So I'm tearing down your shrine. I'm going to live the life that's mine and see myself as fine. Yeah, maybe that's the key, because I've got someone more important to be in the actual universe than a parallel universe me.
Well, I think you speak to such an important point, Daniel, of you know, these fantasies that we create about what life would be like if only, you know, or getting stuck in the eddies of the whys rather than looking at the hows to unstick ourselves. And how really true internal freedom and true choice comes from opening up possibility rather than getting stuck in these fine corners.
So, so good. Everything you're saying is just setting off sparks in my mind, because you're pointing to an essential distinction that I make with people in my mental chiropractic work, the distinction between possibility and hope. Now, hope is not a bad word, you know, but if you make this discrimination, this discernment between the two, hope can veer into idle fantasy, which is another trauma response. We go and we daydream, we tune out, and we imagine the ideal of how it would be, and then we live there. And it's like a drug, because we get a temporary hit of, you know, just like pornography, you're getting this fantasy, completely distorted, but sanitized, uncomplicated, unlifelike version of something that we all desire. But afterwards, there's a cost to it, and you have to come back to the real thing, and it can really mess with your ability to live in the real world. So hope can turn into, you know, my favorite Canadian author, Stephen Jenkinson, talks about the three, do you know him? Have you read his stuff at all?
I've heard of him. I haven't read his stuff.
He writes about elderhood and death better than anyone I've ever heard. And I interviewed him once about Leonard Cohen on my Lyrics to Go YouTube channel, because we both are big Leonard Cohen fans. But anyway, he says the three great narcotics basically of our society are cope, dope, and hope. And so that's hope in that sense. But possibility, what you just said, that's alive right now. It's not some theoretical someday possibility. It's, oh, wow, joy is possible. Okay. Peace is possible. Intimacy is possible. Connection is actually possible and available to me. Now choice has just entered the room. Absolutely. And that's invigorating. That's just, you know, invigorating. And that's making friends with reality and seeing all the richness of it.
Well, your own agency to achieve that, right? It's no longer in the hands of somebody else. I mean, there are always external factors that can play a role, but ultimately what we choose to focus on and amplify in our lives is within our domain.
Yes, it is. And agency is one of the four A's of healing that we describe in part five of the book. Mm-hmm. Authenticity, acceptance, and anger of the healthy variety being the other three. But agency is very, very important. It also crops up in another part of the book when we're talking about childbirth in a medicalized society. Obviously we talk about the advantages of so-called natural labor and the way nature would want us to give birth and all that, and the wisdom of midwifery and all that. But ultimately, it's not so much about the specific method of birth as it is about the woman's sense of agency, which is completely taken away by the medicalized surgical approach to childbirth in this society. And, you know, my dad interviewed a woman who had a C-section, which is not what she wanted. She wanted a vaginal birth, but she felt that she had full agency, consultation, autonomy, authority throughout the whole thing. And she described it as joyful. So agency is huge, huge.
Absolutely.
How does an adult child begin the journey to heal and repair estranged relationships with their parents?
Well, I don't want this to sound trite, but it starts with wanting to. Mm-hmm. And you have to actually want to. I mean, everything starts with intention. That's the first thing I do with anyone in my mental chiropractic walks. You got to set an intention that's going to trump the status quo, because otherwise the way it is has a way of staying the way it is. And there's a part of us that's very comfortable with the way it is. It's worked so far. It's gotten us this far. So if we want it to be otherwise, we have to really tap into that longing and see, what am I really longing for? Now, here's the thing about adult parent-child relationships. It can feel really urgent, but it's actually optional. You don't need each other the way one of you needed the other before, and the other one isn't obligated to the other the way they were before. It's the only relationship in the world that's not entered into consensually, like deliberately. I had no say in the matter of being born, never mind, much less being born to these two particular people at this particular location and time. And they were completely responsible for me. And when I met them, I was a little blob of incontinent protoplasm who didn't have even a sense of individual identity. And they were fully grown adults with like careers and opinions on the world and all kinds of stuff, right? It's completely unequal. And then over time, some kind of balance, you know, but they're still the parent and I'm still their child. And it's the most past-based relationship in the world. But yet when we both get to adulthood, it's no longer vital for life. And there are children throughout history who have moved away from their parents and never seen them again. They've gone to seek their fortune in some other continent or whatever, which is totally an option. And some people are estranged from their parents and that's the way they want it to be. They would rather not put in the work. So you got to identify yourself. Am I on team worth it? Am I on team? Let's give this a shot. If you are, then where do you start? Well, a few guiding principles seem to work for people. And this is coming out of the workshop my dad and I lead on the topic, and which will be the topic of our next book. One of them is be careful that you don't fall into the trap of 50-50. What do I mean by that? We hear it cliches like relationships are 50-50, or there were two-way street, or it takes two to tango. If you want to have a miserable relationship, have your relationship be 50-50. If you want to have a relationship that works and has the chance to grow and transform over the over time, it better be 100-100. But even that is a bit of a fallacy, because if a relationship is truly 100-100, then the other person's 100 is none of your business. So it's really just the relationship is 100. I take care of my side of things. I'm 100% responsible for my experience. Whatever they're doing is whatever they're doing. I may not like it. I may have conditions around it. I may not tolerate everything that they do, or like, you know, put up with it or just go along with it, which may be a sea change from how I've always been. Maybe I grew up fawning and accommodating and appeasing, and maybe having an adult relationship really needs to mean me standing up for my own authenticity, which might mean setting certain boundaries or whatever. But even in that case, I'm responsible for my boundaries. I'm responsible for the conditions I set. I'm responsible for knowing what's good for me and what's not, and saying yes or saying no, or saying a qualified yes, you know? So taking on from the beginning, whether you're the parent or the adult child, divesting, unsubscribing to the Netflix show called What Are They Up To? And really putting the focus back on like, all right, what's my intention and am I behaving in a way that's aligned with it or not? And then you're flexible and you deal with the situation as it arises and you're starting from wherever you're starting from. I think having a healthy relationship with the past is very important. You can't, on the one hand, you can't minimize it or spiritually bypass it. You can't force forgiveness when it's not there. Forgiveness isn't really something you do. Forgiveness is kind of something that happens. It's grace. You know, there's a reason Shakespeare said the quality of mercy is not strained. It's not effortful. It's not an act of will. You can have an act of will that I'm not going to use it against you anymore. Right. But the feeling of forgiving is actually, you know, it's like debt forgiveness. It's like the whole thing just gets lifted and it's a burden off both of you. And you can't really force that. You can encourage it by seeing things clearly for what they are. And when you see things clearly for what they are, you may get to a point eventually where you see there's nothing to forgive. That your parents did what they did. They probably did their best. And even if they didn't, that was their best. Their very limited best. And now you are you, or now I'm me, and everything that's happened to me has made me the person I am today. And again, if I want to be happy and have agency, then I better take responsibility for who I am moving forward. So don't minimize the past. Don't be like, oh, well, if you're still resenting the past, admit that you're still resenting the past and deal with that. Don't expect them to deal with it for you. they may or may not want to listen to what you're resenting, but there may be conversations you need. So it's dynamic, it's fluid. There's actually no how to. You have to deal with whatever you're carrying. You have to look at what you're carrying. You have to look at, what's my point of view about the other person? Because we think we see each other, but we actually don't. We see what our point of view, what our fixed point of view about them says. It's very rare that we ever see a human being for who they actually are right now, outside of the filter that we've made up about them, right? Because mm-hmm. my mom could, if I think my mom is an overbearing B word, I'm just being a generic me now, I'm not talking about my actual mother. But if that's my view of her, then let's say she's really nice to me one day. Well, what am I going to see? I'm going to see an overbearing B word on a good day, and I'm just bracing for the bad stuff to come back, rather than saying, wow, my mom has this really pleasant side to her. You know, if we think they're out to get us, then we're going to take everything personally. So taking responsibility, first of all, for our point of view about the other. If a parent tends to be fall into the guilty parent prototype, we all have these prototypes we fall into, these pre-made scripts. The guilty parent will tend to view their child through the lens of they're broken. I broke them. They're my mistake. They're the consequence of my fuck up.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to, you can't have a healthy present day relationship looking through that lens. You just can't, because the person being viewed that way, even if they're used to it, it's not good for them. It doesn't match who they actually are. It doesn't see the possibility in them. And ultimately they'll resent it and resist you. So you have to, I'm speaking to both parents and adult children now, because it's basically the same thing with a few structural differences. You have to take responsibility for your intention, take responsibility for your relationship to the history, take responsibility for your present day view of them, and then understand your own tendencies and see how those throw you off the scent of what you actually want. And eventually you get to the point where if you can set an intention that really lights you up, that feels like a true possibility, then you have to set up architecture structures that'll keep that new pattern going in that direction, because the past, you know, the drift of habit is so, so strong, you know, left to its own devices, mm-hmm. you will revert to your old patterns. Yeah.
Have you made peace, Daniel, with the past? And do we ever find peace and happiness and joy through it all? Like, can you put it there and leave it there and not have anger, resentment, and that bitterness that we have sometimes?
Mm. I think peace is something we have to keep making. You know, just like couples never stop making love, so to speak. You never stop making peace. You have to maintain the peace. You have to keep the peace. I think that's what it is. Again, it's not a destination. It's an ongoing engagement. So if peace really matters to me, see, what I have to deal with, first of all, in terms of making peace, is there's a part of me that's not interested in peace, period. There's a part of me that would much rather be right than be peaceful. So that part is going to always want to crop up and mm-hmm. subvert things and co-opt things. If I decide that peace is important to me and I make that my intention, then I need to observe what are the conditions that need to obtain for peace to be there. When do I feel peaceful around this person? When do I not feel peaceful around this person? In terms of making peace within myself with the past, I think that comes with forgiving yourself, liking yourself, seeing that there's something in you that can't be ruined or destroyed, that your trauma is laid on top of a core essence that ultimately never went anywhere, and reconnecting with that. I certainly know that the more angst I've had about myself, the more my dad drives me crazy, because I see him as the cause. You know, but as I accept who I am, warts and all, and stop wishing I were someone else, that is me practicing peace. Maybe practicing peace is the best way. You know, it's a verb. We have to keep creating it, and then we get to live in it. But the conflict the turmoil is always waiting around the corner in some corner of our minds. The minute we don't want to take responsibility, the minute we feel like a victim, the minute, you know, and it's just a matter of managing that, maintaining that, tuning up our minds so that it's aligned with what our actual intentions are. So it's never finished. I think, again, what does it serve to assume that there is maybe some destination? Well, it can only serve to discourage you or to motivate you for short bursts followed by disillusionment and disappointment. So it's actually designed to lose. It's not built to get you to the place that you're theorizing is there. Far better to say, what does peace look like right now? What does peace look like right now? I'm feeling really tumultuous. Okay, how can I have maximum peace about the tumult? I hate my father right now. Okay, loving is my intention. Well, I can't change the fact that I feel hatred, and it wouldn't be loving to try and banish it. So what's the loving approach to having hate?
It's developing a relationship, it sounds like, with trauma, with yourself, and perhaps maybe exploring and expanding on your values that anchor you through the decision-making that we do, right? Getting clear, like you talked about, Daniel, keeping your side of the street clean, in essence, in the relationship, and getting clear on your part of it and how do you stay on the path that's most healing and helpful to you.
Yes, absolutely. And you really need to have a taste of victory for that to happen. You have to know what peace tastes like to want more as a value. You know what I'm saying? Like it's not some abstract moral value. Like I believe in peace. That's a recipe for rigid behavior. That's not supple and flexible. But if I know what it feels like when I take responsibility, then eventually I'm going to get to the point where it's just silly to choose anything else. And I'll know where to find it when it goes missing, because it's really important to me. It's something I'm going to nurture and take care of. And that's when things become real values, because we're valuing it. We're holding, we're prizing it higher than other forms of currency. Like that is gold. Value comes from whatever you actually value. And you have to see the value in something before you can treat it, before you can treasure it.
I valued chaos at one point or a few moments in time. Have you ever done that?
Valued chaos? I don't know. What did that look like for you?
The cycle. You get caught up in... And that was comfort. Chaos was comfort. And peace seemed scary to me. You know, it seemed mundane and boring and just lame at one moment in time.
Yeah. Peace is for normies.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah. I think that's why they call... You know, this is a term, edgelord. You're edgy and, you know, never at rest, and that's based. It's just stupid. So terms. The internet is so stupid. And yet it's where we all live. Look, like I said, I have bipolar tendencies, hypomanic tendencies, let's say, and identifying with the chaos, identifying with, oh, that's me. That's just me. Love me or leave me. But underneath that is, if I'm just calm, you're not going to pay attention to me. Or I'm not going to be interesting. I'm going to be ignored. I'm going to be overlooked. So I got to make myself special. And one way to make yourself special is to always be in motion. You can be the Tasmanian devil, you know? So I've found certainly romantic relationships is one area where chaos has been very salient and compelling to me. And that is a cycle that I am currently determined to break, because I have been so drawn to either drawn passively into relationships where I'm not really into it and there's the chaos of the other person's anxiety that I have to then manage and keep at bay, or in the case of my marriage and in a handful of other cases, my desperate desire to win someone over who is not win-overable, who's actually not really there. And who, if I really respected myself, I would see that and I would bow out. But the little boy in me whose idea of intimacy is reconnecting with mother after a long period of desperate estrangement, will do anything for that one moment of intense union, well, that requires that there be a lot of chaos and effort and hard work, because otherwise, what is there to overcome? And I don't think "We Shall Overcome" should be your love theme song. I just don't think that those two things go together. But that's been the way I've operated, and that's who I've been attracted to. And it's very addictive, and it's very hard to, you know. But so I've only recently realized that that was a normalized myth for me, that that's what love is. And so it's about, and yeah, and part of me has to grieve that, because I'm going to miss that. Even though there's a lot of suffering in it. I mean, if I was a heroin addict and I was kicking heroin, I would expect that I would really pine for those days chasing the dragon, because there was those moments where everything is just right. And it's like that with, you know, intimacy too. So yes, I have certainly prized chaos because it was the next best thing to what I came into the world wanting, which was security and mutuality and reciprocity and flow. And as a great addiction researcher, Vincent Felitti, says, it's hard to get enough of something that almost works.
Mm-hmm. But like, you know, we've talked about expanding perspective and looking at possibility, learning to discern that in relationships, and how empowering it is to realize that out of the chaos, when we can quietly connect with a partner, that evokes a softer neurological nervous system response where safety and trust actually live,
yes,
which is kind of what you're talking about. What a wonderful possibility to expand on that too.
So I hear.
Rumor has it, right?
Easier rumor said has it. Then. Yeah. Well, I deeply hope. And at this point it is a hope. Like, I'm not in the realm of like, yeah, it's right on the tip of my tongue. Like, I'm not quite there. I'm still sorting through, you know, I'm still looking for the light switch on this one, but I certainly long for that and think I have a lot to give in that arena that I haven't been able to give because I've been ruled by habits that cut things off at the pass, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but that sounds really nice to me.
Yeah, those defense mechanisms show up in so many different domains in our lives.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't think this was going to turn into the, like, who wants to date Daniel podcast, you know, the like single guy ready. This is my dating profile. Single guy dealing with his trauma, ready to make a substantive change in his romantic patterns. Almost ready. Hit me up if you're. That's
funny. We'll make sure to pass along all of the inquiries to you as they come in, Daniel, because I'm sure they'll.
Yeah, I'll send you my height and weight and profile picture and all that. Perfect. All that stuff. Yeah,
I'm so, yeah, that stuff is lost on me. I don't get the world we live in. I'm super old fashioned. Conversations, yeah. and connection, or I don't know.
I think that's very right. Wise. I think that's very wise. No, I'm not on the dating apps right now, partly because I actually want to retool things before I. Engage like that again. You know, there's too much habit energy about looking for the next thing.
Yeah.
And I don't trust it anymore. I just don't trust my best. I don't trust my best intentions unless they're put into practice in a really new way.
Sounds like a lot of growth.
I'll see. You can only really track, you know, if you're tracking your kid's height against the wall, you know, you don't measure them every single day. Hot never was you know, every 6 months you have to track your growth. Yeah. 1 week. It's, and that attitude has never steered me wrong before. So I do have faith. If I don't have exact trust or possibility, I do have faith in some part of me that knows where it's going.
It's a good thing to know. You have so many eclectic interests, Dan. Is there one thing that you hold the most passion for?
Well, if I had to pick one activity or one avocation, you know, it would probably be music. because, well, in a way, there's no because. Music is just music and it's magical. But it occupies a special place in my life because I'm the only real musician in my family. That thing is mine, and it's been since I was born. I was harmonizing to the Beatles on the piano before I could even reach the keys. I've got perfect pitch. I love music. I hear music in a very particular way. I love listening to music. I love creating music. Is my air conditioning too loud? Or sorry, my heat too loud? Okay. And it's also nonverbal, meaning that it predates my clever coping mind. You know, it's a deep wordless expression of something that is very connected to a core part of me that I can't access purely through words. Now, words are a great expression of my mind, and I love sharing my mind. Clearly, you can tell I like words, and I write lyrics as well, and that's something I'm very proud of and I really enjoy. But there's something about music that is connected to the deepest part of me that that I think stands out above everything else. I mean, I'd like to think that there's some principle that holds together all the various eclectic pursuits I have and interests I have. There's a kind of mission to it. There's a calling. There's something I want to give to the world, no matter whether I'm collaborating with my dad or working alone or writing musical theater or doing this mental chiropractic thing or whatever else I end up doing. I would like it all to be an expression of a single appetite I have for making some kind of difference. And, you know, I have some ideas about what that is, but yeah, I think if I had to pick one, I could cat song show if I ever lose my eye, if I lose my mouth, as long as I don't lose my fingers and I can still play the piano or the guitar. And I would love to keep my hearing too. I don't want to be Beethoven. I think that I could live with that.
In your music writing, where do you find your inspiration from?
Oh, everywhere. I didn't grow up as a Broadway fan, so the sound of Broadway is not super core to my musical taste. There are structural rules to writing musicals that one can learn a lot from listening to Broadway musicals. And there's more adventurous Broadway musicals than others. I mentioned, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar is one. The work of Stephen Sondheim is very advanced and exciting musically, but also conceptually, writing about real dark human themes, real life, real stuff people deal with. It's not some fantasy thing. And there's other musicals I love, Fiddler on the Roof, Little Shop of Horrors, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. But most of my influence, I would say, comes from popular music, which is what I've listened to my whole life. Steely Dan is a huge influence for some reason. There's things so sophisticated and tasty and complex about their harmonic language paired with a lyrical approach that's just like darts. Like, it's so specific and character oriented. Every song is a different character and they're all losers and like creeps and reprobates who are all kind of lovable in some way and like slightly self-aware. And I just, something about me, it's like my id or something, this neurotic jerk off. But you know, I'm just as likely to draw on Chaka Khan or Michael McDonald or the Beatles or Metallica or Soundgarden and even, or Ani DiFranco if I'm writing on the guitar, or Indigo Girls. And hip hop is another huge influence. I used to rap under the stage name RDJ at Hip Hop Karaoke New York City. I don't know if you can tell from looking at me why I had that particular, those particular initials, but I love hip hop and I've learned so much about wordplay and flow and rhymes and how to delight the ear from listening to rappers. It's tricky when writing musical theater. I don't want to break into rap willy-nilly because there's all kinds of cultural consequences. Like it means something more than just, you know, but I do have a couple of songs where a character gets angry enough and clear enough on what they want to say that there's kind of just a rap break. And it's not like a yo-yo hip hop break. It's not written in that style, but in terms of like pointed, carefully constructed rhyming, rap has a lot to offer. And if I ever got a chance to write a show that had hip hop in it, if we ever got to the point where that wouldn't be immediately cancelable, which I fundamentally don't care about. I think the art will stand on its own if it's good, but it'd be a huge risk because 99 times out of 100, it would be done very badly. So it would take a very, very high standard and definitely collaboration with others to make something like that work. I would love to, because, you know, as a word lover, I think hip hop in general is the greatest single cultural advance in the use of the English language, maybe since Shakespeare. I can't think of anything comparable about the just complete revolution in how words are used, metaphor is used, character, attitude, rhyme, cadence, phonetics. It's just, you know, people talk about reparations for Black people in America. Maybe, maybe not, but we certainly owe them royalties just for the incredible contributions to culture that have been co-opted and adopted and just normalized into mainstream culture. Starting with the blues, jazz, soul, rock and roll, funk, R&B, and hip hop. I mean, these are the foundations of American culture, and you throw in a little bit of Jewish humor and maybe a few other contributions from other ethnic groups. I guess the Appalachian white bluegrass tradition is, you know, country and all that is important, but yeah. So you can tell I love popular music traditions, and increasingly I think sometimes classical finds its way into my music depending on the project. My latest show is called The Sweet Hereafter, which may ring a bell for Canadians because Adam Egoyan made a very beloved Canadian film starring Sarah Polley and Ian Holm and Bruce McDonald back in the 90s, which was nominated for an Oscar. Maybe the most beloved Canadian independent film of all time, based on an American novel by Russell Banks. I'm adapting that into a musical. Not a very fun story about a town that loses most of its kids in a bus crash. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, incest and alcoholism and adultery and all kinds of terrible stuff. But it's ultimately, I think, a very beautiful, inspiring story somehow, because it looks at the darkness unflinchingly and unsentimentally. So I'm turning that into a musical. And we're doing a student production of that in Philadelphia in the spring at a theater festival at a college there. And that show is my most classical score I've ever written. It's not classical music, it's not opera, but it's mostly sung through, meaning that there are very few just straight dialogue scenes. And I'm orchestrating it currently for string quartet, which is a very kind of classical sounding, you know, band setup. So yeah, I make room for everything. Whatever, I try to find the theater and the drama and the character in whatever style of music I'm appropriating.
We hear motion creates emotion. How did you know walking was key to what you needed in life? And obviously now with Take a Walk with Daniel and applying it for others, how did that happen?
I just had a hunch. I just knew that I enjoy walking. Look, the only reason I do this mental chiropractic thing, I'm not a therapist. I'm not trying to be my dad. I just like it. I like having conversations where something gets crystallized for people and they get out of their own way and they go from stuck to unstuck. I just dig that. I get off on it and I enjoy it more when we're walking. And a friend of mine, once we were having a conversation, we were walking in East Souk Park in Victoria or near Victoria, BC. He said, "You're really good at walking with people." I'm like, "Huh. Yeah, I really like this format of having intentional conversations while walking somewhere. Like, these are the best conversations and it helps pass the time while you're walking." So that's where it came from. Someone else called me a mental chiropractor and it stuck. I thought it was a good term to describe what I do because it's not, you know, eternal patience trauma therapy. It's more like okay, what do you want to shift? Let's shift it now. Let's not wait. Let's do it in the next hour and 15 minutes or next hour and a half or whatever. So I really, really enjoy that. And I wouldn't do it if I didn't. And I'm getting the chance to do it a lot more now that the book is out. Walkwithdaniel.com if anyone's interested.
Well, I appreciate you. And thank you for your time today, man. This is great.
Thank you for your generosity too of extending it. That was really kind. Thank you.
Really my pleasure. Again, I don't tend to do things unless I fully enjoy them. So it's a compliment to you guys. So Mandy and Zach, thank you for having me. And I do look forward to your impending New York visit.
I will look forward to it as well. And stay in touch.
Absolutely.
Thank you again.
Bye, guys.